We're going to call the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform to order. We have a quorum present. The first order of business is to approve the minutes. Would someone be willing to move the minutes for January 20th?
Madam Chair, I'll move that.
Representative Baker has moved to approve the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Okay, members, we'll get right into order of business for today. We're going to be hearing House File 191 relating to child protection. Are there any members, are there any members in the audience who have not signed up to testify and are willing to testify today or interested in that? If you are, you can see one of our pages near the door if you just want to raise your hand, pages, and you can go sign up and make sure you get on the list with them if you're interested in testifying today. To bring the bill before committee, well, actually, let's have Representative Kreisha come forward first, author of House File 191. And to bring the bill before the committee, I will move that Representative Kreisha's bill, House File 191, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. And Representative Kreisha, I understand that you have a DE1 amendment. And so I will move the DE1 amendment. And members, you have that in your packet. So that would put the bill in the order that the author wants it. Is there any discussion to the amendment at this point? Otherwise, we'll get it moved, and then the author will explain to us the bill. So with that, I move the amendment be adopted. Is there a second? Representative Pearson seconds the motion to move the amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We have one more oral amendment that is also in paper copy in members' folders. It's labeled the A1 amendment. Makes a slight change to the language. Representative Kreisha, this is, once again, to get it in the order that you need the bill in.
That's
and
true.
So members, we're just doing this to make sure that it's the way that the author needs the bill. And so I will move the A1 amendment be adopted. Anyone second that motion? Representative Zerwas seconds the motion to move the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Okay, I think we have all of the logistical stuff done to get the bill in the shape you want it, Representative Kreisha. So with that, if you want to present your amended bill, and then we'll have testifiers come after you introduce us to what's all going on in the bill. Representative Kreisha.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, members of the committee, for the time. And before I introduce it, I just want to share a couple things. There's a tremendous amount of people that have been working on this, a tremendous brain trust. And I have to thank the task force, because really what I'm doing is carrying the water of the work they've done. And I'm proud to do that. I'm honored. The bill that you have in front of you, I think, addresses some of the things that we've had concerns with. It's a start. I think there's other things that we'll be looking at. But this is our good first effort. But before I do that, I want to share a story with you. When I was a language arts teacher in Ivanhoe, Minnesota, a town of 800 people, I was teaching middle school. And I had a student by the name of Rebecca. Rebecca loved to read. She loved to write, which is, as a language arts teacher, that's what you want, right? And Rebecca would come to me quite often to try to get help because she wasn't a very good student. She struggled. And the other problem that Rebecca had was when Rebecca would come up to me, her clothes were often soiled very, very badly. And she always had lice. And the odors that she would have because of personal hygiene were absolutely terrible, incredibly offending. And I will tell you that I'm ashamed as I look back, because every time she would come to me for help, I would cringe. I would cringe because of how difficult it was for me, which was the wrong response, because I it shouldn't have been about me. But more importantly, as I thought about that, how difficult it was for Rebecca. And so I was a young teacher who talked more than he should have. And probably push buttons where he shouldn't have as well. But we had a special ed review, and we brought in social workers as well. And I remember we coming into that argument, and everybody was about how we, I kept hearing from the parents, and I kept hearing from the special ed department, Rebecca just can't do the work. Rebecca's not up to this. Rebecca's never going to be this student. She was a high D, maybe low C student, if I could get her there. And I remember the whole conversation was about how Rebecca was not going to get there. And I knew better. I said, no, this child has wonderful potential. And so I lashed out at the parents who were there, and I lashed out at the conditions she was living in, and I made it very well known that this child, that there was an intellectual child sitting inside here that we couldn't get to because all the adults were getting in the way, that we were not reaching what she really needed. And it was an incredibly, incredibly difficult situation. So I look back on that now, and I realize how hard our job is in the child protection system, how hard law enforcement has it, how hard the court system has getting to these kids. And so what I think we have in front of you members is a bill that prioritizes those children, that prioritizes the issues we're dealing with. We're not going to be perfect, but it's a start. And I think it's a constant reminder that we have to make that that's really our focus as we look at legislation and we try to do the best we can in statute. One quick note that I wanted to bring to you, and I want to make this absolutely clear as all the conversations I've had that you heard it yesterday in testimony, all these services are voluntary. Remember, if the families aren't going to work with the system, there's nothing we can do, there's nothing that can be done until the court intervenes. So this is all voluntary. The kids don't have a choice. The parents or whoever's in the situation has made that choice. The other thing is, notice, as you looked at the flow chart, and I have a handout for you that I gave. Yesterday you saw the flow chart of, I also included one today that we received, which is the front end child protection, and you notice all the interactions. All the interactions that we try to do on behalf of these children. And I want to call this out to the many social workers that I've talked to in law enforcement. Notice the interactions that we have by CPS, law enforcement, to blame our system when families and parents are given plenty of opportunity to fix it is just wrong. You can't blame the people that are working on this. They're trying really, really hard. Now, we can try to put some consistency. We can try to put some services in place that will help them. But I don't think we want to use things like people are falling through the cracks and this and that, because there has to be an onus on the family and what happens there. And remember, behavior is very difficult to modify, and no statute can do that by itself. So this is a very complicated situation. So let me talk a little bit about the bill you have in front of you. We have a number of testifiers. The bill itself is off of recommendations that come out of the Child Protection Task Force. The first thing that we're going to do in this bill that was recommended is we're going to seek statutory repeal of the screened out reports not being used as historical information. So everything that I think Representative Mullery and I have heard, and the task force has heard, is that we need to be, that all the agencies need to be able to look at that information. So if a report is screened out or screened in, we're not going to set that aside. We're going to allow that to come into play. And in fact, in the bill, it's called out that that must be looked at. So if a report comes up when they assess the risk situation, they must look at that history if it applies, if it's there. The second thing is the bill is going to revise the public policy statement so that children are first, and so that is paramount in the decision making. The reports of maltreatment, whether they're screened in or screened out, will go to law enforcement, and you may hear some testimony on that. I'll call to your attention, that's already in statute. A lot of what we're recommending in this bill is already in statute. We're just clarifying it. The statutory definition of physical abuse is modified because the way the statute reads now is you have to do this in anger for it to be considered maltreatment. In some cases, the word anger and that context has been taken out. You no longer have to be angry to maltreat your kids. So not sure where the history on that, but it seemed to be the right approach, that if it's maltreatment, it's maltreatment no matter how you feel at the time.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question to that point. I realize this is an existing law, and I think it's good that it gets rid of the requirement about anger. I just, as I was reading this just now, I happened to notice that it says there on line 5, 8, and 5, 9 that abuse does not include reasonable and moderate physical discipline of a child administered by a parent or a legal guardian, which does not result in an injury. I don't know. I was just wondering what an example of moderate physical discipline would be, because that's specifically exempted as an example of abuse. It lists several things that are examples of it. I mean, I couldn't help thinking of the situation with Adrian Peterson and his son, just reading this, because I don't see anything about, you know, striking a child with a switch. Or I was wondering if that would constitute moderate physical discipline. I don't know if it's, this is a question for somebody from the department or something, I guess. I don't know, if you have any comment on it, that would be great, or if this is something that could be looked at as the bill goes forward, I think that would,
sure,
that would be good.
And Representative Krisha, if you want to answer that, and then I will just add, we'll let you finish presenting the bill, and then members, we will take questions specifically for the author after we take testimony from the folks that are here to testify. So if you want to speak to that, and then if we need to build on and kind of get more clarification, we'll save that for when we're wrapping up at the end of all the testifiers. So Representative Krisha.
If I could, and I appreciate the question, and thank you, Madam Chair. If I could have you hold on to that question, because we're going to have a number of testifiers. And one of the things, and Representative Mullery brought this up as well, and I understand it, and we can't get to every situation. In fact, one of the conversations we've had is what is moderate in many cases. And it's one of the things that we're trying to work on, but I don't think we're going to get there in a perfect world. But I think that should be, I think as you hear the testimony, it will give you a better understanding, and there's certainly more intelligent people in this room than I that are going to give you a better answer. So the next thing is that we want to make child safety the focus of any assessment investigation, and statute should no longer identify family assessment as the preferred method. I want to call this out specifically because I think you'll hear testimony on this. And this is page 2. And this comes around the oral amendment that Representative Zerwas moved for me, and thank you for that. So you've heard a lot about the two-track system, the family assessment versus the investigation. The definition of substantial child endangerment is very important, and understanding that is very important to how the risk is assessed. So what is done in this bill is the preferential treatment of saying family assessment is the preferred method is taken out. The task force recommended that go away, that we allow allow counties to figure out the best course of action to work with each situation. Some of these families are very, very challenging, and we don't want to come in an adversarial way if we can do a family assessment. So, or if we need to investigate, we need to investigate. So the recommendation is, and this is the language that is being proposed, line 1.26, I believe that's my copy, I want to make sure you're the one, that require an investigation when the report alleges sexual abuse. Now, sexual abuse is in substantial child endangerment, but in all the organizations that I talk to and agencies, we want to call that out. If sexual is in the allegations, that should be investigated. And then, or substantial child endangerment, comma, as defined by subdivision 2 and paragraph C. Representative Freiberg, you touched on this a little bit. When you read the definition of substantial child endangerment, there's still a lot of questions to be asked, and I'm sure every time there's an individual case, there's lots of questions to be asked. The second piece is four, item line 2.1, provide a family assessment when there is no alleged substantial child endangerment. So essentially what is being done in statute is we've identified where we absolutely need to investigate, and statute has identified where we shouldn't, where we can do a family assessment. In other words, we're trying to get to a point where there's low risk to the child. The problem is my original language had low risk, but because this process is identifying risk, we were actually one step ahead. So now what we've done in statute is we've identified the top and the bottom, and I'm sure we'll have some testimony, but I wanted you to understand why we're there. We're centering around substantial child endangerment. And if I could call on the researcher, Ms. Aves, to make sure I got that right.
Ms. Aves.
Madam Chair, yes, he did get that correct.
It was your language, I hope so.
Nice work, Representative Precia.
So,
Representative Precia.
I'm sure there's lots of questions. Do you want to take testifiers? Do you want me to stand for questions? Do you want Representative Mullery to make a couple comments? Where would you like?
Yeah, if Representative Mullery wants to make a couple of comments, and then we'll go to testifiers.
Well, Madam Chair, basically, since I was on the subcommittee that most of this came out of and Ron wasn't, I was mostly going to answer questions, but there's a couple points you missed.
Okay.
Bill, that you're going to be, that'll be requiring that they follow state guidelines, and I believe, and I can't remember if the very latest draft has, that any modification has to come after approval by DHS. And we found in my committee, my subcommittee, that some counties were making up their own guidelines, which were screening out an awful lot more than about half of the cases that should have been in. And the other point was that about the screened out reports as well as the in ones have to be kept 5 years, and the screened out ones have to have in them why they were screened, the allegation and why they were screened out, so that a later person looking at this can determine what's going on the whole situation. Those, I think, are two points that are important.
And thank you for that. And I should add,
Precia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. Go through the chair. we did call that on the last page of the statute, and to your point, Representative Mullery, we are asking if, when guidelines come up, that they are sent out, and upon written receipt, they are followed immediately. So once they get them, then they must start to, now remember, that doesn't mean they have to be at the final form, they just have to start working on those and implementing them. So, and the whole idea is consistency. We have 87 counties. If DHS comes up with rules that come through our process, those should go out.
Okay, well, with that, why don't we move to testimony from folks from the public that are here on the bill, and then we'll come back to you two gentlemen as we proceed with the bill. So the first person that we have is Mary Olson, if you want to come forward, and the next person up will be Vicki Underland. And just as we head into hearing from our testifiers, did you have something you wanted to distribute? Okay, you can just pass it around.
I need them back, so I just wanted to pass
them. Okay, so we'll pass that around the table. And just so everybody knows, both for questions and testifiers' comments, this bill will be going to civil law to handle data practices issues, as well as other committees. So we're going to try to keep our conversation and comments to things that are within the jurisdiction of the Health and Human Services Reform Committee, that being the issues related to DHS, the county work, and the work that the social workers are doing handling these cases. So with that, if you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mary Olson. I recognize some familiar faces here. Hi, Diane. I served in the Senate from 2006 to 2010. I really wasn't expecting to be back here ever again, but some things that have happened in our private lives. My husband and I, a couple of years ago, decided that we were interested in adopting, we were hopeful, a sibling group from foster care, because we're older parents and we'd already raised some children. That's what we thought we wanted to do, and we thought we knew something about the system we would be getting into and the kinds of issues that children were likely to be having who we'd be adopting. And we found out, like most parents in our situation, we were incredibly naive and uninformed about the kinds of issues that would be we would be facing by taking on a sibling group who we were very fortunate and blessed to have placed with us within a pretty short time. I've asked to be handed out an email that I sent to your committee administrator, which gives you a little bit of a rundown, and I would be happy to answer any questions anyone on this committee might have.
And Ms. Olson, I'm sorry, I'll just interrupt briefly. It is in your packets, members, a copy of the email that she submitted for the committee's review, which has more of the details. I'm sorry, Ms. Olson.
No, thank you. And I would just please ask you to respect the privacy of our children in terms of that email. So I don't want it to be public, and I really would like it not to be. I don't want to go into more details than I have to here. That's why I asked that to be handed out. But for the purposes of what's relevant to your committee, The three girls who were now struggling to meet their needs, which are really very substantial mental health and emotional diagnosis as a result of their entire growing up years and even before they were born with an older sibling, extreme abuse and neglect. And I think the social worker told me there were 17 different separate incidents and contacts with social services over those years, not counting what social services knew generally about the circumstances and family where they were living. And that included two family assessment cases that were opened and doesn't appear from the notes to have really made any progress or difference or much compliance, and then closed again. And so what I would like to say is that I very much support the work of this committee. I'm grateful for it. I'm grateful for the governor's task force. I do think it's unfortunate that apparently there were a lot of caregivers, people who were foster parents and people who were have adopted from foster parents like me, who asked to be a part of the committee, and I'm not sure who made the decision, but we're told essentially that you were looking at this at an earlier point than when children go into foster care, so their input wasn't really what you were going to be looking at. And from those of us who talk about this, we have a Facebook group, a private Facebook group of about 800 people who've adopted from foster care, and so we have a real good communication tool. So I know there were a lot of people who asked to be on the group. And what happened, I mean, this is not a systemic thing where you have an abuse, a decision to make an investigation, and then if there's an investigation, maybe a placement into foster care and so forth. These are kids who are cycled through the system most often over and over again. Often the reports come from the foster parents, or even like us, they don't. The children are not disclosing what actually happened until sometimes a long time after the fact. And so you really, really need to hear from people who are the caregivers, who care the most about these kids than anyone, and who know the most about the difficulties that they have faced in helping these kids get the services that they need. Because I know that it might seem overwhelming, but the only way that these children, who are wards of the state if they're in foster care, who we have a special responsibility to, the only way that they have a chance in life is if they get the attention that they need. And so I would just, I mean, by that I mean mental health services and educational services, many of the things that are not happening right now. And most of these kids, when they're left in the system for this long before they're finally taken out, I can't say most, very many of them end up in permanent residential care because the damage that's been done to them is so great at that point. This whole system needs to be evaluated. And again, I'm probably already over my time, so I will just say that any of you that would like to meet with us as a group, we would be happy to do that at a later point. Because of the privacy of our children, we would want to do that privately. But I think if you can hear some stories from people who have been in the same situation as me, you'll have a better understanding of what I'm talking about and maybe what the good work that's being done here I approve of, but how much more needs still to be done. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Olson, and thank you for sharing your story and for taking on the incredible job of, after raising your own kids, adopting these girls and raising them and giving them some hope for their future after a very devastating start. So,
well,
Ms. Olson,
it's for our benefit that we're doing it, and we feel very grateful that we're having this chance too. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Next, we have Vicki Underland Rosso. I'm pronouncing that correctly. If you want to correct me for the record, that would be great. If you could introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Certainly. My name is Vicki Underland Rosso, and I'm with the Hennepin County Citizens Review Panel. And I'm here speaking for them and for myself to say that we strongly support this bill. The idea of putting children first is paramount in changing what has been a system that has often served not to put the children first. Our panel for Hennepin County was established in 2009, and the purpose of the panel is to look at what's going on in child welfare in our county. And since 2009, we have consistently talked to the county and reported that we see a problem with the fact that prior history has not been considered in screening. Several people on our committee have looked at across the country what happens, and something like over 30, I think it's 37 states specifically require that previous complaints have been be looked at. The others don't necessarily require it, but our state, as far as we can see, is the only state that requires it not to happen. There's something wrong with the fact that Minnesota is the only state that has said you should not be looking at prior history. So since 2009, we have consistently talked to our county about changing that. It obviously has not changed and could not because of the state law. The second thing that we really like in this bill is the improvement of data, including the length of time data is kept and the act of increasing the capacity to extract data. Right now, it's almost impossible to get data out of county records when people are looking for it. So social workers don't even bother because it's too hard to do. Third thing is changing the intake process to more adequately protect children in danger. We need to increase the funding for supervision and training of the social workers and other people involved. We need to begin informing reporters of the outcome of their report. And we need closer work with the police, all of which are included in this bill. So we as Hennepin County Citizens Review Panel strongly support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Members have any questions? Okay, next we have Vivian Jenkins-Nelson. Is Vivian Jenkins-Nelson here? Okay, we will move on for now to Kathy Gilman. And next we'll have Tony Carter come up. So, Ms. Gilman, if you want to introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony, please.
I'm Kathy Gilman, and I have been a foster parent for the last 12 years. I've worked in 5 different states in the mental health field. I have over 40 years' experience. I'm also a parent support provider for MACMA. And I've been silenced for 4 years. And I'm exploding as of January 1st because I switched my license in order to be able to speak. I'm now with the private agencies, which I get a lot of support from. We've had over close to 50 children in our home, and 4 years ago, we had a sibling group of 3. When our little babies came to us, 18 months, 2 years old, and 3 years old, they ate out of the garbage cans, they couldn't be touched. They bit themselves, they pulled their hair out, they didn't sleep. It was a 24-hour job, 7 days a week. My husband had to stay home from his job for 2.5 weeks. I lost 7.5 pounds in 1 week. I knocked on every door. I begged for help. I could not get any help for these children whatsoever, and I don't give up easily. Finally, we just closed the door and we said, who will deal with them ourselves? We're not getting any help. So for 8.5 months, we did the best that we could with these children. I have been threatened. I've been told if I don't be quiet, I will no longer get any more children, which did happen. I have a good guardian at litem on my side, so they tried pulling the children, but she fought and the judge said, no, you can't take them out of her home. They were returned home to their parents, where my youngest baby was strangled. I got a call anonymously from the hospital because I'm not allowed to have any information, even though I was the respite provider and I continued to have a good relationship with the mother. So I called the mother the next day and I said, I'd like to come and pick my baby up, the youngest, because that was the one that was being abused the most and had the most severe issues. picked her up, kept her for 5 days to keep her safe. I was called on the carpet and got in trouble for that. The children came back into the system when we were on vacation, were put in another foster home, and they were in two foster homes before us, and no one could handle them. The foster home they were placed in could not handle them, so I said, give me my baby. They gave me the youngest child back. These children have been through 7 social workers, and we've been doing the best we can to protect them. As of Monday, I got a call. We've had the youngest one for basically the last 2 years now. She went into pre-adoption, and on Monday I got a call. It did not work out. She was placed just before Christmas. She's now back in our home, and we're doing the best that we can, but we need help, and this is not an isolated situation. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions from any members? Representative Mason.
That's quite a story. And I guess I'm finding it hard to believe that you're not getting the help that you need.
I found
it
hard to believe.
Can you give me any reasons for that?
Ms. Gilman.
I'm trying to piece that together. Part of it is a lack of respect of my role as a foster parent. I don't think you have to have a lot of education to be a foster parent. I think you have to have the right soul and the right attunement to your child. Fortunately, I do have an education in it. Like I said, 40-plus years. Even that, I was never considered part of the team. I go to all court hearings for my babies. And when I would call and make the reports, they said, and this was reported to me, I was didn't know what I was talking about. They had the education, even though a lot of our social workers have not been trauma trained. They have 15 to maybe 25 hours of mental health training. And they're overworked. I do have wonderful people that I have worked with within the system that have done the best that they can. But our voice is not heard. And that's why I'm here, and that's why I switched my license, because now I can speak, and I'm not afraid anymore. Because I think I'm with these children. I go to court. I hear their stories. I get up in the middle of the night. They tell me about their abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, what people have done to them. And when I reported it, it didn't get in their files. They disappeared. When the teachers reported it, and now this wonderful adoptive family who is just in crisis, they're crying, they're calling me on the phone, because none of this stuff was in their file. This child is listed as mild. She is one of the most difficult children we've ever had in our home. And nobody would listen. And now not only are we taking her back, our family is disrupted, which is fine, that's my role, but this innocent, beautiful family that stepped up to adopt this child is in complete crisis, and they've been calling me all week crying. So I have to put their life back together, because as of Friday at 3 o'clock, they couldn't get any phone calls back from the county. And so I took this child back in legally. I couldn't take her legally. I've had to take her into my home as a respite provider. So legally, she's not my foster child until the paperwork is done. But because it was a Friday at 3 o'clock, they couldn't get any help. I'm trying not to sound angry here, but I just think of this beautiful little girl, and she deserves more. She's smart. She's got a future. And she deserves more. And this is the tip of the iceberg. It's the tip of the iceberg. And I thank all of you for looking into this.
Thank you.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to say, recognize and thank you for the challenge that you have stepped forward to be a foster parent, and to care so deeply for children who are hurting and have been hurt. In a big way, what I hear through your sadness and anger is that maybe the system has failed these babies. You know, they have experienced a huge amount of trauma. Mm-hmm. And so my question to you is, have the children gotten any services to walk them through that trauma?
Yep. After 2 years,
Ms. Gilman.
Oh, thank you. After 2 years, realizing that I had to circumvent things, and I can't even explain the battle, I was forced to go with a therapeutic agency that I knew, because of my background, was a disaster, and had been a disaster with my previous foster children, but because they had a, I don't even know, to be honest, a contract with the county, we were forced to go with these therapists. And I fought it. We had a meeting, and I was told pretty much I had to, and I said, okay, but if it doesn't work, then I get to choose. And I requested of the therapist, because the history, the therapist previously with my other children had left and taken other jobs. She said, no, I'm here for the long haul. I said, my baby has RAD, reattachment disorder, so you need to stick with this. She said, absolutely. 3 months later, she quit. So that opened up the door for me to say, okay, I'm doing the research. I'm picking what my child needs. My child has PTSD. She has trauma. She has RAD. She has, you name it, she's got it. So I found a wonderful therapist, and this child is starting to thrive. I'm advocating for the trauma-based therapy with children. And the school, things have really started to step up in the school system. They're really being very, very helpful. I live in a wonderful school district. I can't say enough praise for them. The school has came together with the team and with the therapist. They're supporting this child. This child got kicked out of Head Start, by the way. She's thriving. But now we're back to square one because she's had a failed placement. And she met with her therapist yesterday. I met with a therapist this morning. I mean, you can't, one in two people cannot do it with a trauma child. You need the whole system to be supportive. Every one of my spokespeople who I have put into place to support me were there this weekend, with the exception of the county. But everyone else was on vacation and emailed me, and what can we do? We're here for you. The therapist, my new licensor, couldn't reach the county. And I'm frightened to speak because I don't want him to pull her out of my home.
Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
Madam Chair, and so it sounds like there was some type, you know, you took a really strong leadership role mm-hmm. in trying to diagnose the child because of the relationship you had with her. That you, there was some, I would say, you know, in some spheres, that we talk about the protective factors for parents and being part of the planning process. Of the services that I need to create a safe environment mm-hmm. for that child that's a part of your family. Mm-hmm. And to me, I clearly hear that you was trying to do that leadership role mm-hmm. of creating that plan for the needs of the child based on your experience of what would create a better outcome from her. Because we say here that, you know, our children are first, mm-hmm. you know, and they should be a priority, but I can clearly hear that we fell short as a county.
Well,
state.
I feel I fell short.
Yeah. Well, you advocated strongly.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Gilman, let me just, first of all, I also wanted to say that it's just stunning to hear your testimony, and thank you so much for being here and for the work that you're doing. It's really very, very impressive. And obviously, you know, making sure children get a decent start in life is about the most important thing a person can do. I just wanted to ask you, though, as we're sitting here listening to this, I don't want to have it be one of these situations where you come, you tell a story, you leave, and that's the end. And so I want to ask you, I don't know if you've had a chance to read the bill that's before us. I want to ask you if you think that things in there will help make the situation better, generally speaking, not necessarily for the children that you're dealing with at this point, but are we on the right track? Are there things that you're seeing that we're not addressing? I mean, this report that's in front of us or this bill that's in front of us is really intended to be sort of the front end of the system. It doesn't deal with services that would be given to children after they're identified and so on, recognizing that. But I just wanted to ask you, if you can, to kind of bring it down to what action we should be taking here, if you know, to make things better from your point of view.
Well,
Ms. Gilman,
to be honest, I just came last Tuesday, I think it was, to kind of observe and ended up speaking. And since then, a lot of things have opened up. I've gotten millions of phone calls and been in touch with different groups that want to improve the system. I'm not overly familiar with the bill. I do feel it's the tip of the iceberg. I do feel you are on the right track. And but like I say, I think it's the tip of the iceberg as far as how to improve things. Give people a voice, like the foster parents, the people that are actually with the children. I don't have the answers, but I know I'm on a committee right now that have hundreds of people. We've joined up with Mary Olson, who spoke before. Never met her until today, but we're from the same hometown, we found out. So it's just, I don't have the answers. I just know what I went through, and I couldn't get help, and I went to every level. I knocked on every door. I went to the task force. I tried to get on the task force, but foster parents can't be on the task force. Mm-hmm. So I guess we're just looking to you for help.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Gilman. And I think that, you know, you're in the right place in terms of getting your story heard, and it's brings on a lot of really great questions and things that we need to be asking, and so I encourage you to stay in touch and reach out to your own state representative and the people around this table, and if there's things that need to be addressed by this committee, a lot of times the bills that we hear are the kind of things you're talking about, ideas that come from people who are working within this system and recognize places that are broken. So please stay in touch, and hopefully we'll see you again soon and can come along and make it better going forward.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Next we have Suzanne Allegro, if I'm pronouncing that right. And if I'm not, correct it for the record, please. But if you could introduce yourself, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Suzanne Allegro, and I'm the Program Administrator for the State Guardian Ad Litem Board. And I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this very important legislation that you have in front of you today. And I would also like to thank the Child Protection Task Force for all the work they've done on in order to bring us to this point. By way of background, for those of you that aren't familiar with the guardian ad litem, per both federal and state mandates, a guardian ad litem is appointed on every juvenile case alleging that a child has been abused or neglected. The role of the guardian ad litem is to represent and advocate for the best interests of the child in a particular case. In doing so, the guardian ad litem functions independently of any state or county agency. We represent on an annual basis about 20,000 children each year. Guardian ad litems are mandated reporters, and many have made child protection reports during the course of their work in juvenile and family courts and have firsthand experience with how the screening guidelines are applied locally and the results of those screening decisions. In some instances, our program personnel have filed child protection petitions on behalf of the children when an agency has declined to do so. The children we see in child protection matters often have been the subject of multiple child protection reports that were screened out. Many other children and families have been through family assessment prior to the filing of the child protection petition, and family assessment failed. The chair of our board and representatives of our program testified in front of the Child Protection Task Force based on the work that the guardian ad litem does on a daily basis, and provided a number of recommendations to the task force, many of which are reflected in the bill today. Recommendations from our board included keeping screened out reports on file, using past reports to identify trends, escalation, potential for risk, well-rounded and executed reviews and oversight to ascertain performance and identify training issues, establish consequences for non-compliance with family assessment, limit repeat family assessment assignments, case monitoring for family assessment compliance, identification of necessary changes in support service and overall progress to address situations that brought the family into the system, and also repeal of the recent statutory change from last year regarding the prior maltreatments that we do believe that the prior history should be looked at. Given the concerns and information presented to the task force and the mission of our program, we support the modifications to the public policy statement to reflect that when child abuse or neglect reports are received, the health and safety of the children are the primary consideration. And we also support striking the requirement that family assessment shall be the preferred response. Additionally, we are in support of the clarification that all reports alleging sexual abuse must be handled as investigations. There are several provisions in the legislation that deal with collecting, sharing, and the use of data. We are very much in favor of providing as much information as possible to those involved in the child protection system so that all of us may have the most complete information in order to make quality recommendations and decisions regarding the safety, permanency, and well-being of the children in the child protection system. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for members? Okay, thank you for being here. Next we have Hank Morotsky. If you want to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Hank Morotsky. I am a national child welfare professional. I serve on Child Welfare League of America. I served on the Child Welfare League of America advocacy boards. I serve as Department of Human Service committee, and I'm also a director of communications development for a private foster care agency. But I come to you not as a professional today. I come to you as an alumni of the child welfare system. I was first introduced to the child welfare system when I was 5 years old. My mother came home, and we were allowed one meal a week. She would cook a big meal, and that pot of whatever she cooked had to last the week. So oftentimes, me and my sister were hungry. And so I was on the counter and trying to grab something from the cupboards. And oftentimes, what I would do is we would eat, and then I would seal the packages back up so my mom wouldn't know what we were what we had done. Well, she came home and saw what we had done and threw me from the counter across the trailer and stomped on my stomach so hard that I coughed up blood all over the carpet. I was in a foster home for a period of time. I don't remember what it was, a couple weeks, maybe a month or so. And then my mother put us on an airplane. It was my first flight ever, and we moved to Virginia. Our social worker visited us in Virginia at one point in time for something. I don't remember exactly what. We moved back to the Twin Cities. By the time I was in sixth grade, I had been in eight different school districts. So when we talk about sharing of privacy and data, that's something that I think is going to be very important in this bill. So there are four parts of this bill that I support from a personal perspective, and one of them is that previous reports and family history should be considered. When you look at my biological family, I have generations of abuse, incarceration, mental health, and suicide within my family. I have numerous aunts, uncles, and half-siblings that are either incarcerated or committed suicide. So I come to you, you know, a lot of people look at me and say, hey, you know, good job, we're real proud of you, Hank, you've done well. But I'm here despite my child welfare experience, and while I'm a huge child welfare advocate, I think that the bill that you are proposing is a great start and will have dramatic impact on the system. The other piece that I believe is important is that the child well-being is important to connectivity to their community. Who the child was already connected to, their permanency or family reunification and kinship through adoption, and also normalcy needs to be incorporated. My second experience in the child welfare was when I was 11. I still don't know to this day what happened, but my mom came home from the bar, she was drunk, she took the belt off, I knew exactly what the belt meant, and my back had lacerations open all over it, and I just went on with my day because that was a normal weekend for me. Well, next thing I know, the police are there, and they took me out of the home. During that period of time, from the time I was born to the time I was 11 years old, we had a family that took care of us from time to time. They were not a biological family, but I called them grandma and grandpa. And one thing I told the police, and one thing, you know, I remember the police asking me, do you have any family members? And we didn't. We were disconnected from the rest of the family. So we went and we spent the weekend there before I was put in St. Joseph's Home for Children. I was not allowed to stay there because they weren't my biological family. And I think that when you look at the well-being of children, you need to look at who they're most connected with. Because to this day, I'm regretful that they weren't allowed to take us in. While I was at St. Joseph's Home for Children, the message that I got as an 11-year-old boy was, "We're waiting for your mother." So I was in St. Joseph's Home for Children from June 21st, 1987 to October 7th, 1987. And during that time, I never knew what day I was going to go home and what day I was, what was going to happen to me, whether I was going to go to residential treatment, be adopted, no clue. On October 7th, I was placed in my first foster home. During the next 4 years, from 11 to 15, every 3 months I was going to go home. So I wasn't allowed to play baseball because, you know, if I joined a team, I'd have to, my foster parents believed if you joined something, you should see it out. Couldn't register for some summer camps and things like that because we don't know if you're going to be here or not. So my well-being and my normalcy experience was not a priority for that experience. Finally, at age 15, through the encouragement of my case manager and through the private agency that I was placed in, I told Judge Alan Oleski, who had spent a lot of years in family law, I looked at him and said, "I'm done. I want to be a normal high school kid. And I want to stay in the community I'm in. I'm starting to develop friendships. I want to play sports." So for whatever reason, and I don't know to this day why, and I have connected with him a couple times, he honored that request. And unfortunately, my mom wasn't going to voluntarily terminate her rights, so I was still stuck in limbo. So the other piece is support for older youth in the child welfare system, because we know that recidivism they're going to enter the social services system again. When I look at, you know, you look at my family, I'm the only one standing here with a college education, and the society is paying. My sister's kids have already been in foster care. I have a brother that's incarcerated. I've never met him. So society is paying for those experiences anyways. So those are the four things that I support in this bill, and I think are important starts as we move forward.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. Questions? Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, what do you say for you besides being a survivor? So I just want to say keep surviving every day, because what we do know is that those who abuse become abusers. And so, you know, through your story, you know, I didn't hear much services that was given to you. You know, we talk so much these days about brain development and adverse childhood experience and ACEs and the impact that has on us later on in life, and how much we as a state pay, you know, for those consequences where we didn't do the work up front. And so, you know, what do you think as you was, you know, going from place to place or in limbo, that could have helped you and your siblings to be more productive citizens?
Mr. Moratsky.
It's around that permanency and normalcy piece. Actually, there's a friend of mine in the audience. She was a member of my church group, and that church group was probably one of the best. I mean, three of my best friends come from that group. That did more healing for me. Being able to play sports did more healing for me than anything. And when I turned 18, it was very clear. My foster parents made it clear they were doing me a favor by letting me stay until I graduated from high school. And they were doing me a favor by... letting me stay until I go to college. And that's something that I'm very, very passionate about. College did more for me in healing than anything. I was homeless during college. I almost dropped out a couple times. I pay more in student loans right now than I do in my mortgage. These kids don't have the same social scaffolding and safety nets that even poor families with strong values have. So it's not about the money, it's about the values and the support. Having a place to go home during the holidays. So, you're right, I didn't receive a lot of services that were centered around me. All of my treatment plans, all of my case management meetings were all around what is my mom going to do. And the reality is, you know, when we talk about transparency and family history, and if, you know, I moved 12 times. during while I lived with my mom. How are the counties going to know what happens, especially when you're moving out of state? My sister moved another 6 times. She was never taken out of the home. She was sexually abused by my mom's boyfriends, and she was never taken out of the home. So where was that data? Where was that information as part of that family history? And how long were we going to hold on to mom might quit drinking before, you know, an 11-year-old boy gets to live a normal adolescence? So there really wasn't, and that's why I'm doing what I do now.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here and for sharing your story. We truly appreciate it. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Fisher, did you have a question?
Yes, for our most recent testifier.
Mr. Moratsky, I'm sorry. We have one more question for you. I'm sorry. Representative Fisher.
Mr. Moratsky, thank you for sharing.
Where is he?
I'm right here.
You all look alike.
One of the things that caught my attention real quick was when you talked about when you were at 15 trying to figure out what your options were, et cetera. I work at a homeless youth shelter, and we see some of these same issues come through on a very regular basis. Would it have helped if you felt that at that point in time the system just was not making it? You felt lost, disconnected with the foster care system. Where were your capabilities? Do you think that if there would have been some kind of limited emancipation for youth, where you would be able to make a little bit more choices about what you needed for your and have more guidance, would that have helped you in your situation? Do you think?
Absolutely. Do I think Judge Oleski made the best decision he could at the time, given the laws? I had asked numerous families through my church group, school, to adopt me, and they tried, but they just couldn't. So absolutely. I also think, when we look at our emancipated youth that are 15, 17, 18 years old, they need to know that there's that scaffolding and that safety net that I talked about past 18. I believe, and this is just my theory, that a lot of kids end up going back to what they know because at 18, it's a big cliff. I was pushed off that cliff. Thankfully, I sailed a little bit. But if a kid knows that they're going to have some sort of support, some sort of safety net to launch into adulthood, then I think they would make better choices. I'd like each of you to just think about your own personal experiences. How many times did you move back home? How many times did you have to borrow a couple $100 from mom and dad for a car repair? Or you needed a place to stay in between jobs? We've all experienced that, and these kids don't have that. And that's why they fall back into what they know and what their family histories are.
Representative Walker, and then we'll probably need to move on to the next testifier.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Moratsky, for sharing your stories. I had worked earlier on some legislation. I know other people have, and I just want to let you know that at least I don't think the scaffolding is as strong and sturdy as we'd like, but I think we've made some improvements. We do have that you are a child aging out of foster care has eligibility for health insurance provided by the state through age 21 so they can continue to get whatever support and relationships with counselors that they may have been involved in because of the abuse they've experienced. We do provide for, as I understand it, free tuition at the Minsuit colleges so that they can pursue higher education and have, you know, without having to graduate with the loans that you have, and that they can continue to request support services and continued involvement of the social service system. They may have left it and feel like they have to come back when there's life direction. We still don't have it all put together, but I just wanted for anyone who's watching to know that we're trying and that we have built at least a little bit of a framework.
There has been some change. There has been some advances, and they're definitely very helpful, and they would have changed my experience. But it's also very difficult to navigate. One of the things that I'm working on is how do we share the college options better. These kids, they don't believe that it's really an option right now because it's not. They're not being educated on it.
Thank you.
But I do agree, and I thank you for that.
Thank you, Mr. Moratsky. Next, we have Michelle Zender-Fisher.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me back here again today. And I come before you to
indicate that this bill is a very good first start at the changes that I think the task force will be bringing forth as we continue the important work of the task force. And we talked about that yesterday, that there's things that we continue to need to work on, and this bill incorporates a lot of those changes that we recommended to the governor in our report. The piece that I feel the most strongly about is allowing us to consider prior reports, and this bill accomplishes that. I do want to go and answer the question related to the reasonable and moderate physical discipline of a child. And now I'm not remembering who asked that question.
He's not here.
Okay. I'll hold off on that question and maybe approach afterwards. I would indicate, though, that the statute does indicate does not result in injury. And I only had one opportunity, unfortunately, to see the photographs that were published. And I don't believe that it would not be acceptable under Minnesota law, what I saw in those photographs. But the one piece that I've already talked about addressing in here is the language regarding the guidelines. The recommendation from the task force was to ensure that the guidelines established by DHS serve as a floor or a baseline, that counties have the opportunity to offer more, but that they are a baseline, and that there is always the ability to communicate regarding those guidelines if there are circumstances that don't quite meet the guidelines, and that the consultation then comes in with the county attorney's office if the guidelines don't quite meet what the facts are that are presented. Sometimes counties respond to that by saying it doesn't meet the screening criteria and therefore we're not going to assess it. And I think I've proposed language and we've had some discussions, and I think we're going to be able to address those concerns. But I thank you for considering this bill. I am very appreciative of the swiftness with which it is moving forward, because I think it's a great first step and important work. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thunder Fisher. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just help me understand one thing. Could it be a problem that Child Protective Services, they don't have places for these children when they do identify maltreatment? And is that driving any of the lack of response to take action? Are there barriers that prevent families from becoming foster families, that we could ease that burden or increase the supply of those families so they have places to place these children that are safe and protective? Is that something that we need to address as a legislature?
Ms. Bender Fisher.
Thank you. That wasn't the target of the task force. However, speaking as the county attorney who handles child protection in my county, I can tell you that foster care resources are very limited, and that we do need to work to try to license and recruit competent foster homes for our children. I don't think that I would endorse that we're not taking children out of dangerous situations because we don't have some place to put them. What might happen is that we have some foster homes that will serve as emergency placements but not long-term placements, and unfortunately if we need to immediately pull a child and all we have are emergency homes, the child may be placed in an emergency home and then have to be moved again, which we know is very damaging to a child. So the answer, speaking not as a task force member but as a child protection prosecutor, is yes to all of the questions. We need more resources, we need more families, we need support to foster parents, because what foster parents have to endure and provide support to the children is something that I don't think any of us have the ability to comprehend till you're there dealing with a child who's waking up and at all hours of the night dealing with their trauma, and we need to provide them with support.
And Representative Schultz, and just for members, as we're time is starting to get away from us, if we could try to just focus our questions on the content of the bill, just in the interest of time and further testifiers. Representative Schultz.
So maybe in the future, then, I would like to investigate these, if there are barriers from recruiting families to make it easier in the future. So if we can come back to that, that would be great.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll talk to the author offline.
Okay. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, thank you very much for the work you're doing. The one thing I heard yesterday regarding the five-year period of reporting back to, we could take a look back, have we figured out the ability to go from county to county, so that's all in the same system, and how about if they cross a state line? Where are we at with that at this point, if you would share that, please?
Ms. Enderfisher.
My understanding is there's some ability to go in-state. We have some ability to do that. I think we need to increase the ability to do that through our IT services. The ability to communicate across state lines is a very complicated issue. The statute allows it. I believe you have to get to a state that also allows that state to share their information with you. I did mention it to an aide for a U.S. senator about maybe needing to start looking at systems, because it is a very significant concern. We've had it happen in our county where families, once you start investigating, they disappear, and we know they've gone someplace else, and there isn't an ability to do a national search.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kreisha.
If I could, I think this is a very important point, and thank you for the question, and thank you, Madam Chair. But if you get back to one of the intents of the bill is to try to make this consistent across all 87 counties, the reason for that is we know these families move. And we know that if we can't get consistency, because for lack of better words, they know the system sometimes better than our workers do in the sense of how they can get around it. And we want to make sure that as they're moving from county to county, we're staying one step ahead so we can get to those children, so that we can make sure we're consistent. So that's why you see the guidelines. That's why you see the emphasis on the consistency. And I think we've heard that loud and clear from the county social work and the attorneys and the task force.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. We do have a few handful of testifiers left. Judith Brumfield, if you want to come forward. And again, just a reminder, we'll try to keep our comments focused on the content of the bill, just in the interest of making sure we can let everybody testify that wants to today and allow time to wrap up the bill before 4:30. So with that, if you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Judith Brumfield. I'm the Health and Human Services Director in Scott County. I'm also a member of the Governor's Task Force, and here today, though, representing the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of Social Service Administrators, or MACSA. As one of the representatives, one of the county representatives on the task force, I just want to assure this committee that we feel like we've been full partners in looking at and seeking really some substantive changes to our system. As counties, we believe that we can and should strengthen the child protection system, but that we can do that best by building upon the strengths that we already have within our system. We certainly believe that there are changes that can be made, things to do better, but that we also have a system that we can, for the most part, be proud of, that we continue to make changes, continue to make alterations, just as you've heard today, looking at the older youth. So it's a growing system. It should be constantly changing, and we can't ignore the fact that there are some strengths there to build upon. While there are still many details to be worked out, we hopefully will be able to fully support any bills that come out of the task force. However, you're going to hear a consistent message from us, and that message is if we're making any major reforms, any changes that will add to the system, we need to look at resources. And that's resources not just for child protection, but the other parts of the system, which would include the county attorneys and law enforcement, that in many of the recommendations we're saying include those on teams. That's a resource issue. And at this point in time, The state has a very small contribution to child protection, whereas counties fund over 50% of it. So that's not a part of this bill. We know it needs to go through other committees, but we will continue to watch that, and our long-term support really is going to be contingent on having the resources to carry out what we want to do. A couple of parts of the bill that I really want to speak to. One of those is the mandatory screening guidelines. As counties, we are concerned about the lack of consistency across counties. The question earlier about what is moderate physical discipline, the screening guidelines will help us do that. The screening guidelines will help to clarify the law, as well as, so long as they remain guidelines, the department every couple of years relooks at those with a larger committee and talks about how do we want to change these, how do we want to stay up to date as we learn more about children and what they need. Another thing that counties are very supportive of that's in the bill is stronger DHS oversight and guidance. Again, dealing with inconsistencies across counties, we believe that the state as a supervisor in a state-supervised county-administered system really does need to take the lead role in supervising, in assuring that there is consistency across counties, but also in bringing the resources to bear in terms of best practice, training, some of those kinds of things. So we like the fact that in the bill we really do look at a stronger role. As 2 years ago or 3 years ago at this point, the legislative auditor brought forward that there needs to be that stronger role on the part of the Department of Human Services. The other part of the bill that we also support is the screened out reports, being able to look at those to look back. One of the things my supervisor said to me is, I can't not know what I know. Counties already know about those, being able to utilize those. On the other hand, we also are concerned that we have some, again, clear guidance from the state of how to use those screened out reports. We want to be very, very careful that it doesn't become a formula. If you've had 5 screened out reports, now you take the next one. So being very clear that you need to look at the detail of the report you got and then any additional information that might come forward. So, again, I want to thank you for allowing us to have time to comment on House File 191, and we really look forward to continuing to work both with the task force and with the legislature as we bring forward additional recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Brumfield. Next, we have Rich Gehrman. Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. Representative Loeffler has a question for the testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Brumfield, the bill is very clear about the exchange of information between the county welfare agency and the police. What I didn't see, at least in the portion of the law we have here, we don't have everything, I'm sure, that deals with this topic, is that it's not clear who is the lead agency, the expectation of coordination, not forcing the child to go through the same story with, you know, multiple investigators, one from the police, and, you know, I mean, is there elsewhere in the law or some other, I don't know if the cops would be under the DHS guidelines like you are, but is there somewhere, or do we need to look at sort of assigning clear responsibility and some expectation of coordination as we bring the two closer together more consistently?
Ms. Brumfield.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, the best answer I can give you is it depends. There is some clarity in the statute currently that there are certain things where law enforcement takes the lead and child protection can utilize the law enforcement investigation. There is also the practice that coordinates those kinds of things so that you look toward who really has the lead in what's going on in that particular circumstances. There are a lot of times when law enforcement does not get involved. That's many of the neglect situations. Law enforcement gets the report and chooses not to take any action because they don't see anything that would be a violation of law. So there's clarity between the two that child protection has one job, law enforcement has a different job, and when they intersect, they need to work together. At this point, I don't feel there needs to be additional clarity, and it's something I don't believe the task force has dealt with at this point in time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brumfield. Next, we have Rich Gehrman. If you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rich Gehrman. I'm the Executive Director of Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota. We are an advocacy organization, strictly advocacy. We don't do direct service, and we advocate for exactly the kinds of things that are included in this bill. I'm also a member of the Task Force on Child Protection, and am on the work group that works on family assessment and resources. First, I just want to acknowledge, as very broadly for the committee, how much we appreciate ourselves and our volunteers appreciate the leadership from the Department of Human Services on this task force. Often that kind of thing doesn't get set, but there's been a very distinct kind of tone of working with people and bringing people along. Some of the very difficult issues that we have been dealing with were brought up very early on in the process, and Commissioner Jessen, both as the co-chair and as the head of her department, essentially put it out there and said, we're going to discuss these issues openly, and even though some of them are difficult issues from the county's point of view and the staff and the department, and I think that really opened up the process so that the committee, the task force, could move forward much more quickly as a result. So just wanted to express that appreciation. Also, we really support this bill. Very pleased in particular about changing the focus of the child protection system to the safety and well-being of children, and not making family assessment the preferred option. Family assessment has been preferred, and obviously strengthening families is a good thing, but it had, and I think everyone acknowledges this, gotten to the point where too many high-risk cases were going to family assessment, and so this language clarifies that, and I think focuses us on what the purpose of the system is. We also support the other provisions in terms of allowing workers to make collateral contacts and looking at past reports and making sure the guidelines are the floor for the counties. And I do want to call out in particular not only the guidelines being the floor for counties, but also a quality review process being developed to make sure that that's done consistently across the state and that be supported as well. I think one other point that I wanted to make is that there's language in this bill and in other bills which talks about when to assign cases to the traditional investigation track and when to go to family assessment. And I just want to alert the committee that some of these issues are still right in the middle of being discussed by the work groups. And, for example, the decision about when to assign to family assessment or the traditional investigation track is being discussed by the screening committee as to whether that should happen in the screening call or after a worker goes out and makes a visit. And then our committee is really talking about whether even it makes sense to have two tracks anymore. Once we sort out some of the practices and the guidelines, there may be some recommendations saying that to take the best from both of those tracks and have really one process that everybody follows. So just wanted to highlight that. I know that can get kind of tricky when you go into conference committees or when a bill goes through different committees, but that some of this is still in play and there's a lot of moving parts. And so I do thank this committee for taking the time to hear from everybody, and we look forward to this bill moving forward.
Thank you so much, Mr. Gehrman. Appreciate it. Any questions? Okay, we will move on to Commissioner Jessen. And we still have a few testifiers left, and I'll just ask if we could try to focus in on maybe some of the aspects that haven't been touched on yet. If there's anything you want to delve into, and we certainly want to hear your thoughts on it, Commissioner Jessen, and appreciate your time being here. So if you could just introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And I can be very, very brief, Madam Chair. I want to thank Representative Krisha and Representative Mullery, too, who both serve on the task force, but particularly you for your leadership, and say how much at the department we endorse this bill and the direction it's headed. I think that the stories we've heard here, kind of the personal stories, even though some of them are from foster care, really tell us how important it is to take a fresh and deep look at our child protection system. And certainly Representative Loeffler is right, in foster care we have made some improvements, but we also have a long way to go. But I think the fact that really behooves us to take this fresh look, and the task force has started to do this, and this bill is a good start, also emphasizes the importance in the shift in public policy. that this bill endorses. And I want to say how important I think that is. And I think the stories that we heard talking about kind of focusing on kind of family engagement and family preservation, that is really important. Those are important things. But I think we do have to shift back and say the child's safety and well-being in this system has to be first and foremost. Obviously, what happens to parents if a child can safely be with their parents is really important, that safety and well-being, but that we really need to take a fresh look at this whole system with that foremost in our minds. And with that, I was particularly happy about the bill's clarification of DHS's oversight, the quality reviews. We do a number of them, but we don't do what this bill calls for us to the department to do, is let's publicize them, let's summarize them, let's get the word out. Let's have more oversight. Let's work more closely with law enforcement when it's appropriate and be consistent in how we're sharing information with law enforcement and vice versa. Let's look at past history. Not only should that be an option, that should be what we do. We should do that in the individual, not only with screened out cases, but we need to be able to look at what's happened for screened in cases too in other parts of our state, because families, as you recognize, are highly mobile, and we are working hard at the department to do that. There's a few things we are working, we will work with the author on to, you know, some clarifications that kind of both in our role, what do we do in oversight versus what do we do in the statute, a couple of the things that other presenters have mentioned. But I just really want to thank you so much for your leadership here and thank all of you for your attention.
Thank you, Commissioner. Question from Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Jessen, while I appreciate, taking the laudable step of saying taking a fresh look at this, we are in an accountability function here as well. And so as I look at the bill that has been before us, I see no less than five lines where it states very emphatically, the commissioner shall. So your shoulders are being loaded down with a number of responsibilities. And while I appreciate the depth of your desire to move these forward, it conjures up for me a couple questions in terms of how will we know whether or not you're accomplishing the tasks set before you in this bill, Madam Chair?
Justin.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I think one of the things that I really look forward to working with the task force on, and which you'll hear more about in our recommendations, which are due to the, at the end of March, is how we bring more transparency and accountability into this system. I think that this is a system that is too often cloaked in secrecy, and that is one of the major things the task force is looking at, is from both the county and the state perspective, how do we have more accountability and in the system. And so I think that is certainly, we have several proposals on that. We want to talk with the task force and get everyone's insight, but I think that will be a very important part of our work, because you should be able to look and see much more closely how the states and the counties are both doing and performing these important tasks.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more question. Commissioner Jessen, we heard from Scott County representation that 50% of the funding for these programs is supported by the county, but yet they're looking to you for the leadership. She was very emphatic about that. They're looking to you to take the leadership role in some of these from a supervisory. Well, you've got 87 students that are looking to you as the teacher in the classroom in terms of how to adjudicate these programs for the sake of consistency, for the sake of the children that are going through these. So it's not so much a question as a statement as the task is great, and I'm just wondering what level of responsiveness are you going to provide to this committee and others, whether it be through the task force or in statute already that we haven't seen, that would provide us with a level of comfort knowing that the children, the most vulnerable amongst us, are being taken care of in the manner in which that we would understand they to be.
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think in the when I talked about the recommendations around transparency and accountability and how we need to have that increased, you should be able to look at those and have a much better sense about how we are doing. We also, for an example, now we do an annual report. One of our things we're thinking about the department is we can do an annual report, but we could do quarterly updates with a lot of those figures so people can track more closely how we're doing, kind of like. So, for an example, the issue of whether reports of sexual abuse, are they being assigned to family investigation? How are those being resolved? That you'd be able to look at that more closely and track that more than just an annual report that comes out, you know, 6 months after the year ends. I also think that we have a new county performance measurement system that we're working with the counties to put in place. And we are actually starting in the children's and families area. And we want to use that as a way to be able to track really county by county how they're doing on some of these critical measures like reentry into the system. So I think that there are several ways that we are measuring that. I agree, Madam Chair, Representative, this is a large task. I do feel it is one of the reasons we also are trying to have kind of a new set of leaders to help us do that. Hired a new Assistant Commissioner, Jim Koppel, who's here for Children's and Families last year, a new director for this part of the department. We're taking this very seriously.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Jessen, thank you for your work on this and for the authors and everyone on the task force. And anytime a tragedy happens like this in our state, our heart breaks. Everybody's heart breaks, and you say, how could this possibly happen in the state of Minnesota? And what can we do to prevent this from happening again? And so I feel horrible for the victims or families, but also for the people at the department, because I know just how hard it is to deal with something like this. And in a report like this and recommendations and legislation, it's by its very nature reactive. My question is, what, after having done this and gone through the process and gone through the recommendations, what would you like to do as a commissioner next?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, beyond this bill, because I certainly believe this bill is a good starting place, but that is what it is, a good starting place. So some of my wish list, I do want to dive down into those transparency and accountability measures that I think are important. I want to take a fresh look at how we do child mortality reviews so that we're not waiting for a tragedy to appear in the newspaper, that we're doing that on a regular basis, and that we make more of those public, which will call for some law changes to do that. But I think we not only have to look at our child protection system, and that includes some of the resources that we're going to need, but also what happens after that? I think you all heard today kind of what happens to the kids. It's one thing to say in the front end of the system, what's what we're looking at now. What can we do to support these kids and keep them safe? But if we need to, do we have to put them in out-of-home placement? And then the question is, what do we do when they're there? Because while we've made improvements, we need, there's much more that we can do for those kids that are state wards to get them adopted more quickly, to make sure that they're safe and living the best life they can when they are in our care and foster care, and that they get to families. You know, I remember hearing this, and I think about it every Thanksgiving. Every child deserves a place to go for Thanksgiving. Or if they're not at home with their family, they have a family who has a chair and is missing them. And we've got to make that true for the kids who end up that we're responsible for. So I look at it more broadly than just this piece, though I think this piece is important. I hope that starts to answer your question, Representative Dean.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. It does, and when I was reading some of the material last night, it struck me that if there was a spill at a mine in northern Minnesota, that how quickly does a bad thing move up the chain of leadership? There would be a chair of DNR, the chair of the MPCA, the chair of DALI, DEED. There would be so many systems that would integrate up quickly to the governor's level, at the cabinet level, when bad things happen. But in DHS, we almost constrict that upflow of information. And I think that that is something at a leadership level that it looks like that you're trying to address, but it's something that I would like to make your job a little less, a little easier with broadening out the upflow of information, particularly of bad things within DHS. And I just think that that's just something that struck me last night after I was reading some of the recommendations and the reactive nature of how we naturally have to respond to these events. That's it.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here. Appreciate it. We do have a couple more testifiers. I will have you come forward. I have to apologize, though. You will have to keep your remarks extremely brief. We need to vote in about 10 minutes. And so if I can have Lorene Broom come forward and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. And again, I apologize for the time constraints, but if you could keep your comments as brief as possible, we'd appreciate it, and we'll all be available if you want to further contact us.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Lorene Broom. I am also a member of the Governor's Task Force. I am a parent coordinator with William Mitchell College of Law Child Protection Clinic. I am the director of the Parent Mentor Network at Minnesota's Communities Caring for Children, also known as Prevent Child Abuse Minnesota. I, too, am in support of this bill, and I appreciate the work that's going into it. I appreciate that we preserve the opportunity for a family assessment in those cases where no substantial child endangerment exists. Family assessment should identify both the strengths and needs of families and provide and monitor services to help families ensure child safety without formally entering the system. I also appreciate or am in support of government entities sharing information, but I think it's Section 7, Subdivision 10, it reads, the local welfare agency must notify local law enforcement when a report is received, including reports that are not accepted for investigation or assessment. I believe some language or some clarity around this piece would be more appreciated, because it does not ensure the directives that what law enforcement can or cannot do. And this would be for the public. What can law enforcement do once they receive the report, whether it's screened in or screened out? And as task force members, this is a difficult work, and we are weighing multiple competing concerns. We want children to be kept safe, and we know how important it is to build strong families. Minnesota child welfare system, when viewed nationally, has among the best outcomes for family. We need to be careful we are not reacting to a few tragic incidents by changing our entire system as if those incidents are occurring broadly. As I appreciate the need for scrutiny, however, we need to be careful to look at our system and not fall prey to the fact that when we look at something long enough, we'll find a way to fix it, whether it's broke or not. I am a parent whose children and family have been impacted by the child welfare system and the laws that we are looking to change, such as the ones that we're talking about on today. And so with that being said, I appreciate the work that's going to go forward as we continue to look at the child welfare system as a whole. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Ms. Broom. Representative Moran, a brief question, if possible.
Based on a parent who's been impacted by the system, but also your work with Will Mitchell in the nonprofit, you know, based on that experience, what is the most important change you think would be that would need to happen for the child welfare system? The most important change, and also the most and what should we preserve about that system?
Madam Chair,
Broom.
Representative Moran, let me repeat what I think I heard you say. What is most important that we change in the child welfare system, and what is most important to preserve? working with William Mitchell, at William Mitchell, I work with families in the child welfare system, families who have lost their children in care. And I believe that effective counsel and parent mentorship being state-funded to work alongside of the child welfare system would benefit our state, because we have different families, we have different children that have different problems, and we cannot address these issues with the same tools that we have in our toolbox from 20, 30, 40 years ago. So when we talk about what can we change, looking into effective counsel, that someone can represent a family or adequate advocacy for a family in court while this family is going through their case. And what is most important to preserve? I believe the alternative response is a very important piece to reserve, because it should be more intentional. It should speak to the strengths and of the family and the needs. I also believe it should be culturally appropriate because of the disparities and disproportionalities of families of color that enter into the system at a higher rate. And I believe I answered your question, I hope.
Madam Chair.
Representative Grisha.
If I could, and I want to thank Tess Fair, and we've heard this many, many times, and she's certainly been, in fact, we're on the same subcommittee, and one that we look forward to. On this issue of the data, I think it's absolutely critical, and I've been approached with a number of groups on that we address that on our way to the next committee, and that'll be one of the next assignments that I'll be working with and working with them as well, to make sure that we're as clear as we can be on that, because it is very important. And as the testifier said, these are a lot of competing interests, and we know the disproportionality of the families that are in this system, and that absolutely needs to be addressed.
Ms. Broom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Crusha. I believe that my personal and professional experience gives me great insight on what is happening in the child welfare system, and our families need to have a voice, need to know that they have a voice, because communities are not thriving as well as they could be. And with that said, I thank you all.
Thank you, Ms. Broom. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just really quickly, and direct my question to Representative Crescia. The one point that the testifier has kind of pointed us to is this issue about notifying law enforcement when the report is received. Every single time, basically. And I just wanted to flag that for you as something I've wondered about. I don't know if we have time for you to address it really right now, but the way I've wondered about it is if every single report goes to law enforcement, whether there isn't sort of a deadening effect of that. You know, if you pass everything along, then nothing really stands out. And I just wonder if there's been concern about that phenomenon, and I know this is going other places, so we don't need to worry about that too much right now, but I just wanted to flag that for you, and maybe you can tell me offline if that's sort of been considered and dealt with.
And if I could,
Representative Crescia, briefly, and then you can follow up as you head to the next committee.
If I could, we have one, if I could bring up the sheriff, because she can clarify this very, very quickly.
Okay, sure. Why don't we bring her up? I understand you were wanting to testify, if that's correct. So if this is the issue you wanted to speak to, that would work out great.
This was it.
Perfect. Two birds with one stone. If you could if you could introduce yourself for the record and then briefly respond to that.
Certainly, Madam Chair. Therese Amazai, Mower County Sheriff, and I will address that issue. We do not become numb to those reports. We get every report currently, or should be getting every report currently. I know in Moore County we do. Several other counties, they do. However, this was an attempt to clarify that and make it even more clear that we will share those reports, whether they're screened in or out or investigated by Human Services or law enforcement. So we do share those, and we do not become complacent. We read all of those that come through.
Thank you so much
you.
For that.
Yes.
Appreciate it. Thank
I'm
you
done.
For being here. Thank you. We appreciate your
question.
Brevity and apologize for that and the lack of time that we have. Phyllis Sloan. Phyllis, not here. Okay. Lisa Hornstein. Hornsteiner, I apologize. If you could introduce yourself for the record and be as brief as possible, and we thank you for being here today.
Hi, Lisa Hollensteiner, Emergency Department Physician. I'm on the task force. I will be very brief. I support the bill. I just want to highlight 2 points quickly. One is the county guidelines. We have to have the counties follow the state statutes. We found out on our task force that Hennepin County, for example, they're not the only one, but showed us their guidelines, which they've amended. I'll give you one example. In front of injury, in accepting physical abuse, they added the word current injury, and the person coming from Hennepin County gave an example of if a child came back from school vacation, Christmas vacation, and had a black eye, and they said, what happened? And they said, my mom hit me over Christmas break. They would screen that out because it was not current. It did not happen that day or the day before, for example. And there are other issues within the Hennepin County guidelines. They're not the only county, but we need to for sure have counties following the state statutes, absolutely. The second is the screening out, and just 2 points with that. One is David Sanders spoke to our task force about how the number one risk factor for child fatality is previous reports, whether screened in or screened out. The second is that the definition of physical or abuse or neglect is often over time, a pattern over time, a pattern of neglect over time, and how will we know that to screen that in unless we can look at the previous patterns? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony on that. And we have one final testifier, Nancy Jost. You want to, Jost? I am not doing well with names today. My apologies. If you could just introduce yourself and proceed briefly with your comments. And after this, members, we will give Krisha a last few words and then go to a vote. If you
Madam
could proceed.
Chair and committee members, I'm here today as a mother and a grandmother. And I would like you to consider the connection between child abuse and domestic abuse because they are often together. And I'm going to quickly try to read a note from my daughter who has been the victim of domestic abuse, and my grandchildren have been the victim of seeing the abuse and being abused themselves. And I'll try to get through this quickly. I'm writing to you to make the connection between domestic abuse and child abuse. This is a condensed story of my abuse and also the abuse of my children. They were abused by the hands and words of my abuser and also by witnessing my abuse. I have been abused, controlled, and manipulated by the same man for 5 years. Our relationship lasted less than a year. Somehow he managed to stay in my life. He is a very, very sick man. I could write for days on the ways he abused, controlled, and manipulated me and my children, but that's just part of my story. My children were terrified of a man that had once been a father figure to them. They were confused how a person they thought loved them and their mother could then turn into someone who hurt them and their mother. This is not the way this is supposed to happen. It is terrifying to see or hear your mother being abused, listen to horrific things being said about her, and being called unmentionable names. They worried about their mother and about being the next victim. My 11-year-old son has a difficult time sleeping alone and has nightmares. My 2-year-old is afraid of men. My daughter stuffs most of her feelings inside, but is terrified of coming in contact with this man. My children will live with these adverse childhood experiences for the rest of their lives. This is not only domestic abuse. This is child abuse. I tried so many times to get away from this man. I even gained the courage to call the police on him. He abused my daughter this time. It didn't do me any good. I showed up at court all but one time. I'm almost done. He manipulated me into not showing up. The charges were dropped. The judge refused to drop the domestic abuse no contact order. At least I had that to hold on to. Turns out that didn't do any good either. Due to an administrative error, the DANCO, the domestic abuse no contact order, was dropped. So the next time the police were called, he was not in violation of any order because this order somehow did not exist. This man choked me so hard I could feel breath escaping my body. But there was no violation, no marks on my neck and no hoarse voice. He was charged with disorderly contact. Many abused women have that moment after many attempts to flee their abuser that they are done. No more. They can't handle anymore. That was my moment. Soon I or one of my children would be dead. I had to escape this monster. I did it. I left. I left my home, my job, my family, and my friends. I left it all for one reason, to stay alive. Although every day was a risk, fleeing is the most dangerous part. I packed what I could into my trunk and all three of my children, and we drove for days. We settled 1,000 miles away from home, and finally we were free. We did it. I had to change my number, tell no one where I was. I was still afraid, very afraid. It was a new life. My children were uprooted from all of their family, friends, neighborhood, and school. I lost my job. It was hard but worth it until I got the news he was trying to get custody of my son that he never cared about and never fathered. I knew this was my punishment. There was always a punishment with him, always. This couldn't be happening. I risked so much leaving. Excuse me. I left everything just so I and my children could stay alive. And here he is, manipulating and controlling me again. He may not be able to physically hurt us, but he is being allowed by the justice system to manipulate and control me, and now it's legal. Mm-hmm. I have to move back closer to where he is because I could not afford trips back home. I am being re-victimized, and so are my children, by the hand of a justice system that is supposed to protect us. The criminal, juvenile, and family court system need to coordinate better so that a violent, abusive man cannot rip a child out of his mother's loving arms into the cruel world of a man that has already shown he is capable of abominable acts. This is the reason why women don't leave. We risk losing our children to our abusers. When he could control me, he didn't care about my son. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you for sharing your story, Ms. Jost. Representative Kreisha, want to give us a couple closing remarks, then we will move to a vote.
I usually have lots of words, but I think the testifiers have done a great job.
Well, thank you so much to all the testifiers for taking the time out of your busy schedules and sharing very difficult stories with us. We're very, very grateful. Thank you for the work of the task force and Representative Kreisha for all the time and effort. We know that this is the first stop of a few more, and look forward to the work that will continue to be done on this bill. With that, House File 191 is recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill as amended is passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. And members, with that, we are adjourned.